Hey guys, this week's episode of A Glass for Every Palate comes with a special gift. Right now, for my listeners, we are offering a 50% off discount on your annual subscription to Psalm TV. So go to psalmtv.com right now, sign up for an annual membership, use code, wait for it, Shakera, S-H-A-K-E-R-A, for 50% off your annual subscription. That way you won't miss any episodes of any of the amazing shows, including mine, on the Psalm TV streaming platform. Go sign up now. All right, guys, welcome to this week's episode of A Glass for Every Palate. I am floored by the guests that we've had this season. And on this one, that I literally feel like I'm speaking to royalty. And you know that for this season, guys, we've chosen a theme for every podcast and every guest that I feel embodies them. So for today's guest, the topic is going to be grace under fire. Because I think that this woman's grace and poise and stalwartness and just genuine pride and joy in what she does resonates in every single space that you see her. Today's guest is Miss Tanya Pitts. Hi.
Hey, Shakera. How are you?
How are you? I am wonderful.
I'm really, really good. I really am. It's been a long week, you know, a lot going on right now, making sure that things are running tip top shape in the restaurant and my own businesses, you know, thriving and still trying to study, still trying to connect with mentees and still have time for, you know, family and friends and, you know, and it's just been one of those weeks. Yeah, you know.
So let's begin. Let's begin there then. Let's begin with a pre and post George Floyd moment where pre George Floyd, you love your job. You're on the floor at a fantastic restaurant, pouring incredible wines, and it's great. But oftentimes, as any minority group recognizes, like you become used to being the only one in the room and it gets a little less awkward, but it's never something that you're not observant of. And you are somebody that you've mentored, you've taught, you've leaned into helping others throughout your career. And then George Floyd happens and there's a great awakening. And now there's so much more visibility on so many things. But being there before and after, I think it's a unique mixed bag of emotions of like, part of it is like, well, finally you see me and others that look like me, but we've been here. But also like, but why did it take y'all so long? So talk to us a little bit about just the mixed bags of emotions of being you in your role pre and post George Floyd.
I'm still the same person. I'm still doing the same things. I'm just doing more of it. You know, it was a lot going to the Wine and Culture Festival last month and being honored with the Legend Award of Sommelier of the Year and having an award in my name to be given to someone each year. And I think you put it all in a nutshell. It was a lot, you know. It was almost kind of surreal, you know, in a way. It really, really was. You know, there's so many different roles and industries that we as people go into and walk into these spaces where we don't see ourselves and we adjust, right? Mm-hmm. We are still ourselves, but
we
not
calibrate
all of ourselves, right? Oh yeah.
We calibrate.
It's like, and you know, and this is another analogy. It's like, you know, assessing the room. Mm-hmm. Watching body language, mm-hmm. you know, it just to figure out who and what that experience is going to be like. It's the same thing when you're about to walk up to a table and start talking to them or don't talk to them. You figure it out, you know, and I say this. I'm a chameleon for different people. It's as though you're on a stage and that's what you're doing. You're a different person for each person, but you're still yourself.
Do you think that I think oftentimes the act of code switching or however we want to brand it,
right.
I think it's something that only gets associated negatively to Black people. I think that other races are just being, right? If you see an Asian person that talks a certain way, it's not assumed that they're trying to be anything. It's assumed that, okay, they're Asian in descent, but they grew up in America and they talk the way they've been brought up. But when it comes to Black people, there's kind of a different scrutiny put on that. And so I wonder, like, are we all being performative to some level? Like, do you think that a part of, because I think that there is some performance and grandeur in being a sommelier, right? That's why there's specific ways of serving. And so do you think that, I guess the question is being a chameleon always a bad thing? Isn't it a welcomed necessity at times? What do you think about that?
I think it's a necessity and it's an asset, you know? And when I say acting on the stage, it's still true. You know, we embody who we are and what we do, you know? And that's really what it is, you know? It's almost like role playing to a certain extent, but we are storytellers anyway. You're a storyteller. Yes. I'm a storyteller. And we all have our own way about us and our own style in which we do that. But this can be said about any kind of person from any walk of life. There is always what people think someone should say, look like, present themselves. It doesn't matter who they are. You know what I mean?
Yes.
People have these preconceived notions of what someone is and who people should be. Right.
I mean, that's why I have a different wig for every day of the week. You'll get five different people messing around with me on any given.
See, you know, hey. But that's what people, it's all about a personality, right? And there are all these aspects of people's personalities, just like in a glass of wine. Same thing.
Yes.
You know?
Yes. And that is such a perfect segue because I think that, I mean, I have the closest people in my life to me are educators. And I think that there's something innately natural about all of them that I can actually pinpoint, whether I can name it or not, that like education's in them. And I think that you are one of those people. I think you're a natural born educator. I think that you are an active and passive educator. I think you're teaching even when you don't know you're teaching.
Yeah.
I mean, we've had tons of exchanges where like, I'm drinking a wine that I think I know, that I think I know the producer, I know the history of it. And then you'll DM me a factoid where I'm like, shit, I did not know that about this. All right, now I got to go try this too. Is that something that you developed over your career in wine? Or do you feel like you're naturally that type of educator, nurturing person? Because it resonates in everything that you do.
I'm naturally that kind of person, you know? And I'm inquisitive. I'm always trying to learn something new and pick up tidbits here and there, and then it's filed away. You know, I use the analogy of the Rolodex. This is the Rolodex. You know, and sometimes if I can't remember, you will see the motion of me next like, to my head doing something about the Rolodex, flipping through. You know,
yeah it's. It's the story of life. And it's so funny because I think that a lot of people, you know, like their first foray into wine, a lot of times it actually is something American.
Yep.
And then the deeper they get, they go across the ocean and they're in the old world and their passion falls there. I'm the same way, right? I started by drinking something that was easily available. And over the course of drinking and tasting, you know, Spain and champagne became my loves. But you have stayed with American wine. Like, I feel like there's no book that I have in my library that can teach me more about American wines than you. Talk to us a little bit about, like, was that your first exposure, and how you've just stayed with a love for these wines and developed a passion for sharing them in a time where people still like, kind of like, oh, you drink American wines. Eh, California wines are nothing. Meanwhile, you're like, absolutely not. You're dumb. Let me tell you, all right, you're not dumb. I would say you're dumb, but here's 18 wines that you should drink that are amazing. Tell us about how your, over the course of your journey, your love has stayed with California.
Well, the interesting part about all of that is that that's not my background. My background is actually in, you know, the wines of the world, because that's how I learned. I learned by being at a table at the end of the night, being underage, being 18 years old, and not drinking wine, but smelling wine and listening to the conversation of others around the table that were professional people in the industry, and they were from all walks of life. You know, they were straight, you know, they were gay, they were Black, they were all sorts of people, right? And that was my education, and listening to them and having, you know, being able to feel comfortable saying, this is what I smell. And yeah, that today is still how I do things. And, you know, there was American wine on the list, and it was on the table as well. But the push for the American wine really came from being here at One Market, because that was the program. The program were, it was American wines. And so that was more of a push for me. When I came on board, figuring out how to bring the experience of American wines to people who walked in the door that did not necessarily know that the wine list was made up of American wines, and mostly American wines from California. And so for me, I had to go through everything that I've ever tasted in my career. And as I would taste wine, pinpoint it to a place in a region around the world that would make sense for someone walking in the door if I didn't have what they wanted from another country. And so that's my process. That's my process.
So it's that it's a translation table almost. It's like, all right, you could get with this, so you could get with that.
Right.
You know, I think that, and we can explore this a little bit, in that I think people's aversions to California wines is that the first one they have is not enjoyable. But when they go back and think about where you had it, like, you probably had the actual worst expression of it you could have gotten, right? Mm-hmm. Like, if you're at a dive bar at happy hour and you don't want to drink a beer, so you get the $4 house red and it's a California cab, that cannot be your benchmark for California Cabernet Sauvignon ever. So who's the more difficult person to get to explore California wines? Is it the already seasoned drinker? Is it the newer drinker? Or is it a hybrid?
It's none of those. You basically have to listen. I always ask questions. What do you normally drink? What do you like? And I can pull flavor profiles from that and find something on the list that is domestic or from California and match it up with them. And they're just like mind blown. Because there are those wines that are produced here in California that could be a wine from anywhere in the world.
Absolutely.
And people don't realize that. You know, it's like someone saying, oh, I don't like Sauvignon Blanc. Well, you just haven't found or tasted a Sauvignon Blanc that you like yet, because they're different flavor profiles.
They're very, very different. Saucier is not New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc at all.
Nope.
Being in a restaurant, it's this unique exercise of always, like, this Rolodex. I think, like, when people think of it, when it comes to people like you, I'm almost like, wait, but it's really hard to keep flipping back and forth when the Rolodex is as full as someone like you with the experience you've had and the wines that you've tasted. So I guess there has to still be challenges in life at all times. On the floor or in any dynamic in your own businesses where you're dealing with guests, what do you actually still find challenging today?
Oh, wow. Still find challenging today.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know. I think for me, it's at the end of the day, you want people to come back and you want them to have a great experience. And when I can't do that, or that is a challenge and I'm not sure if it's transpired or not, It bums me out, you know, but that's that person's choice, you know.
Yeah.
But most times I can turn it around, you know. Yeah.
And that has to be the rewarding part of your career, right? I love that, you know, one of the best things to come out of the pandemic is seeing people push themselves beyond the idea that I need to have one role or I need to do one thing. And you have definitely made that very robust growth and blossoming into these other endeavors and doing virtuals and consulting and teaching all of these things and still managing time to mentor. I want to ask, one, what do you find most enjoyable? And two, I'll take virtual out of it because it just was a different time. But what out of the things that you're doing now, is there anything that you weren't able to do before that you always wanted to? And what was the barrier from you doing those things before?
So writing more.
Okay.
And, you know, I've always written and journaled and I write all my own tasting notes. There was a time where the tasting notes gave a lot of background information because I felt like it was really very important for the staff, particularly if they had never tasted wine or variety from a particular region. I'm a big believer in having something to reference, especially if you've never tasted it before. It could be food, it could be wine, it could be any of that. But if you don't know it, you know, how do you know if it's good or not? Right? And I did that because I felt like I had to give staff something to reference, especially if I had less experienced staff members or if they had never had wine from this particular region before.
Yeah.
I'm a big believer in having something to reference. If you have nothing to reference, how do you know? How do you know whether or not you like it? Just, you know, it's very important. And I still do that to this day. I do it for my staff. I do it for Chef. You know, I bring him into my tastings all the time because I think it's really very important for us to encourage and feed each other, you know?
Yeah.
To keep the momentum going.
It's so nuts to me that wine is so closely associated with food, right?
Yeah.
But if I was giving someone an ingredient that they ever had before, the first question would be, well, what is it, right? And the default answer is, it's like dot, 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 dot. Like, that's how we describe things. If you wanted to learn a foreign language, it begins with a translation. How do I say hi? How do I say thank you? Yet for some reason, the culture, particularly of wine education, is that you're just supposed to have this knowledge bank unrelated to anything. You know, like there's this very specific block of language. And there's a part of me that believes that when you're testing for something, you know, you have to have a set amount of things. But if you're testing for something that is somewhat subjective, like I always use spicy as a tasting note, that's weird to me because everything that's spicy, somebody says jalapeno. Most of the world doesn't think that a jalapeno pepper is spicy. The most populated countries in the world are China and India. Szechuan peppers and every chili in India and Southeast Asia. Spicy is not a jalapeno pepper. Yet if you wanted to describe something, that's always the note. So as an educator innately, how do you think we better universalize the language in a way that it gives enough flexibility for people to find it relatable and receptive? I mean, I use Disney characters to, I'm going to start using my wigs and different looks to describe wine so that people get it. But how do we expand universally how we describe and how we make wine relatable?
Empowering people. The first thing I'd say to someone when they say that they're having a hard time figuring out wine and what things taste like, your first thought is your correct thought because it is subjective. It is based upon your sensory memory that is imprinted specifically to you. There are people that say, yes, but, you know, there are guidelines and it should be like this, that, and the other thing, but I don't always agree with that.
Yeah.
I think that it is what you smell, what you taste is what you smell and what you taste. And it could be something completely different from the other person. And then someone else smells it and tastes it and was like, oh yeah, you're right. That is in there. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So there are markers that certain, you know, varieties have, but where did that come from? Who said that that's what
who said?
That is?
Yes. When people used to say, I remember specifically the tasting note bergamot, right?
Yeah.
I remember being at a tasting group and everybody calling bergamot. And I honestly just said, that could be right, but I have no idea what bergamot smells like.
Right.
Right. And I think it's that space where everyone at the table is like, you never smelled bergamot. No. And I'm not convinced that all of you have either.
No.
I think all of you know what's in the glass and a marker for it is bergamot. And so you're saying bergamot. I don't know if you actually know what bergamot smells like. And that ended up being such a robust conversation because I'm like, well, you say tropical fruit. Is what's tropical to somebody from Ohio the same thing as somebody that's actually from a tropical climate? No.
Nope.
What if I name the fruit that you've never heard of? That doesn't make me wrong. Mm-mm. It just means that you don't know what I'm talking about. Right. So I think that, you know, and this may be something that you can speak about as a mentee. So I'm of the philosophy of if you're taking a test, study and prepare to pass the test. Knowing that what you want to do is pass the test, and that does not mean that it is absolute truth to you. So how do you coach? I think it's one thing to talk to guests and enthusiasts, but you are mentoring people that are interested in careers and professions. So how do you calibrate your teaching style when it comes to somebody that's preparing for a professional exam versus a guest?
Well, when you are studying for tests, depending upon whether it's Wine Spirits Trust or the Court of Master Sommeliers, we are given guidelines for all of that. We are told that these are the guidelines. These are the things you need to study and you need to study it in this way. So we're already being told this is what we need to be able to discern within whatever we're doing, right? And so we're already being told this is what you need to know to be able to pass this test, right? The organizations are telling you that. The organizations are saying you need to learn this grid. If you learn this grid, you'll be able to do this.
Yeah.
Only study the items that are in this book. These tests are based upon the information in this book. We're already being told that.
Are written by very Eurocentric profiles.
And so, and so we're told to do that already. Do I say, yes, do study all of this that's in this book and learn all this? Yes, because that is what we're being instructed to do. But on the other hand, you are still an individual. You're still a person. You still have that independent and personal profile that is yours, that is going to be a part of that after you've passed that test, gotten that credential, and done all of the things, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's so interesting. I think that you might be the first, like, still active on the floor beverage director that we have, and wine director. If you were hiring someone today, do they need a certification to work for you on the floor? And if they don't have it, what are you looking for?
No, they don't. Because you know what? Okay. I am from, I'm from an era of people not having certifications, right?
Yes.
Certifications are a new thing for the United States and for other parts of the world. You know, people have done this because it's a profession and they love it. Same thing with, you know, professional wait staff, professional bartenders. It's their craft. It's their love. They're super knowledgeable about all these things that they're passionate about. And we all have our strengths within spirits, wine, all of it. Even if you go ahead and get a certification, you have your specialty.
Yes.
You know, you have your specialty. And then there are those that have these specialties and are these, you know, professors of knowledge and, you know, prolific. And they don't have the certifications. So, you know,
I agree
it's
completely.
What it is. Yeah.
But it's such an interesting juxtaposition in that, like, you do a lot of mentorship through organizations that have been formed now. And I think specifically when we're talking about anyone in any minority community, BIPOC, LGBTQIA, any of them, there's still this lingering thing of like, I need this piece of paper to even be taken seriously. And there are endless scholarships available now. But I wonder, like, as someone that is in a hiring position, let's say I have a certification and it tells you that someone has tested me on this body of knowledge and I have shown that I have the ability to regurgitate that information back to them to a certain extent. Versus somebody that comes in like, look, I haven't studied this, but I want to learn and I care about this. And I like, how does one evaluate that? Because look, the truth is across the country in hospitality now, you can't get people to come and work there. Like some restaurants in New York that would never have openings now cannot fill openings they have. And people don't want to work there anymore. And a lot of it, whether people want to admit it or not, is there are actually professionals that are like, man, F that place. I've tried to work there for the last 5 years. And every single time I've been turned away for nothing. Nothing has changed about me except the fact that now they're intentional about not excluding people like me. And I don't want to work there anymore. Like, how do you coach both new professionals entering it about how to present themselves as more than a credential and as a person and a professional that is adding value to this industry versus coaching somebody that's been in this industry that has had doors slammed in their face, that is slightly jaded. How do you shift your mentoring style? Like, what's the advice that you give to those two sets of people?
You have to look at the individual, talk to the individual, and find out what it is that they're interested in. You know, I have colleagues and friends that are in that space right now of switching gears and trying to decide what they want to do, how they want to do it. We have a skill set that is sales. Sales can be translated into anything, anywhere. You could leave this industry and go sell pencils and paper. Okay. You could learn, you know, how to, you know, buy Bitcoin and do anything. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, and we have people that are doing that and have done that. We have people that have left this industry and gone into healthcare, you know? Yeah. You know it.
Yeah, it's true.
They're selling solar panels, you know, it's...
If you can sell a product that you know is marked up 60% and people willingly buy it, you can sell anything.
Yeah.
So there's so much cross-marketable skills too. I would be remiss if we didn't talk though specifically about California wines, because I have been intentional about really diving in and paying more attention to how different so many of the AVAs of California are. And I hate the comparison of every time there's a new AVA that people are drinking from, it's like, oh, it's just like Burgundy. Oh, they produce Tuscan style wines. I'm like, if you want to drink Tuscan wines, you should drink Tuscan wines. If you want to drink Burgundy, you should drink Burgundy. Stop comparing United States wines, like you said, and you've kept it as a theme. You can make it relative to that, right? Mm-hmm. It can be, if you like Chianti Classico or you like, you know, Jervis Chambertin, okay, then you should like this. But let's talk California. What AVAs right now are you just super excited about that people need to drink more?
You know, it's not always about the AVA right now because of climate change, which is a real thing. What's really very exciting to me is being able to taste a great variety from a particular area that's never been grown there and to experience that and be wowed, you know, by that. That's what's really exciting to me right now, to see and hear the ingenuity that winemakers and viticulturalists are doing right now and experimenting with. So it's really
I'm loving it.
You know what I mean? It really is.
I mean, we're getting good Albarino from California.
Yeah. You know,
which is insane.
Yeah. Which is not how it was many years ago. You know, it wasn't. Same thing if you, you know, look at Baja. The wines that were coming, you know, out of Baja, they were okay. But now they're delicious. You know?
I'm loving it. I am loving it. Like, I had something from Monterey the other day. Like, of these places where I'm like, you know, these places exist. They're known for lots of things, especially when we talk about Baja and Monterey. Like, they are kind of almost like synonymous with California cuisine, like uniquely California cuisine. Right. But the wines are equally like unique and special and delicious, but we're not talking about that. And I've learned so much from you. And guys, if you've not, like, I need you to follow, we'll talk about what her handles are to follow, but you need to listen to Tanya talk about some of these wines where she's tasted them current, she's tasted back vintages of them, but you started by talking about being a storyteller. And you are so effortlessly masterful at a story. Do you think that is, you know, you do virtuals, you consult on, you know, with wineries on blending and creating and doing all these things. Do you think that your storytelling ability kind of makes you able to almost be an octopus in all these spaces? Because honestly, I mean, guys, you can't see me, but I'm sitting like a kid in a classroom. Like, the second Tanya starts talking, I'm enamored. I'm captivated. I can't move. Like, my phone battery's going to die. I'm breaking things to get it because you get caught up almost in a rapture of your style of storytelling. Do you know how great you are? Let's ask that. Do you know how good you are? You're good at many things, but do you know how great you are at that particular thing?
Sometimes I amaze myself. I do.
Because if you didn't, I was about to tell you that there are very few people that I would put in the category with you on your ability to do that. Being any sort of minority, sometimes you're trained not to really toot your own horn.
Yeah.
But I think that you know how good you are at a lot of the things you do. As you've expanded your professional thumbprint on this, you still have X amount of time to do things. So how did you decide, like, okay, I'm going to grow and expand in these specific ways? And particularly when we're talking about, like, poetic wine experiences that tie into storytelling and that kind of stuff. And also the business of, like, creating new styles that the wine in the glass translates to a story that translates to a guest. How did you narrow down, like, these are the ways that I'm going to expand and grow?
COVID gave me the time to do that, you know, because I am a natural workaholic. And it was something that I already did anyway. Mm-hmm. And it translated to what else can I do? And how can I take what I would normally do on the floor and do it for myself right now and still be of service and help people? And goes back to what I said, instead of touching tables, I was touching people, but in a different way. And that's exactly.
Do you enjoy touching tables and people equally, or do you enjoy one more than the other?
They are intertwined. You can't have one without the other.
Yeah.
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 I think in the last year and a half, we've truly, you know, here on the SOM TV network, it's incredible. Like, say what you want about the films, but there are a lot of people across the country and across the world that became interested in wine because they saw those films.
Absolutely.
But I love that social media and kind of this time when we were stuck in virtuals, where really I think the access passes were removed. Like, people got to sit in on these virtuals with sommeliers like you, with winemakers from around the world that in any other state of existence would have never happened. So now you have all these people sharing space and doing that. And it's like, okay, now the world's opening back up. How do we move this forward? Where do we go? And I think that as we move back to the dining rooms, I think as a society, we've realized that there's much to be done. You know, we see it on social media where people are still now saying, oh, why won't these people go back to work? Like, why? Well, I think that as a society, we need to challenge, like, why were people making below minimum wage working 60 hours a week, 70 hours a week, 80 hours a week? So as a hospitality professional, what is a change you want to see or you would have liked to have seen that still hasn't happened yet? And what do you think is stopping it?
I think that with the labor shortage, the dynamics of running a business and making sure that your employees that work for you are taken care of is changing. Mm. And particularly in the back of the house, you know, there was always this disparaging difference between what was made,
yeah,
you know, what people were making as a living wage. It was more of that than anything. So you were finding restaurateurs and people that own businesses that are coming up with a much more equitable way and process of paying people. And that's been pretty fantastic. The margins of owning a business, particularly a restaurant, are really very, very small. Very,
yes,
very small. And it's...
I don't think people realize that.
Yeah, it's hard. It's
I don't think people realize how... And, you know, I had a conversation, funny enough, with my cousin about this. And we were talking about, like, the differences between Europe and here, right? And I'm like, well, shit, I wonder if we could cut food costs if American portions weren't so damn big, right? Yeah. Or I wonder if restaurants would make more money if they didn't have to put, you know, three servings of something on one plate for a consumer to feel value. What I've loved seeing is sort of a more French approach where we've had this idea in America that the customer is always right and the customer can be abusive and the customer can be gross and vile, but the customer is always right. And I love that across the country, we've seen restaurants and even other guests, like, if you want to see me turn up in a restaurant, let me overhear a guest disrespecting their server. It will absolutely be a moment for me to stand up and say, absolutely not. This is not acceptable. Stop talking to them like that. But I think now restaurants are doing it more. And I think that that's a wonderful thing too. And that the emotional well-being, the safety of staff is now being put at the same level of the satisfaction of being hospitable to guests, as it should be. Like, you shouldn't have to sacrifice one for the other. Like, you shouldn't have to allow guests to disrespect your staff in order for them to feel satisfied at the restaurant. Like, people that work in restaurants and hospitalities are not indentured servants or slaves. It's a job and they're doing it well, but they're not there to be abused.
It's, and you know, it doesn't happen often.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, sometimes you have people that are a challenge. and you work around it, you know?
That was a Grace Under Fire moment. I just want to point that out because I call them assholes. And you just said there are guests that are challenging. But again, as we're talking about language, it's that too, right? Like, I'm not a hospitality professional. So yes, I will actually call you an asshole if you're being disrespectful to somebody that is just doing their job, and their job is to try to make you feel welcome. I just have no patience for it. But in my other work, yes, I deal with very, very challenging users and all of that stuff. And then I take a you approach and I say, you know what, this person is just challenging. They're difficult. They require more effort than I necessarily want to exert. But, you know, it's great to hear that someone like you that is seeing it kind of from all spectrums. You're seeing it from the perspective as a professional on the floor, as an industry leader, as somebody that is managing and coaching and cultivating, as somebody that is speaking to guests and enthusiasts and all of that. I think that over the course of this discussion, I think you guys now understand why I love, and really, I wish my personality and temperament was more Tanya-esque most times. I'd probably have lower blood pressure if it was, but I really like, this is a moment to give you your flowers. And shout out to the Wine and Culture Fest that happened earlier in August. I am so sorry that I wasn't able to be there, but it was glorious to see people like you and so many others receive the recognition and acknowledgement that is overdue. And I'm going to take this moment in this podcast to throw buckets of flowers at you, because I think you are so deserving and you embody what leadership, coaching, and mentoring, because those are three very different things. And you somehow embody the best of all three of those things. And if you don't give yourself credit for that, allow me to, because you are amazing and inspiring in that way.
Thank you so very much.
You really, really are. And at this time of the show, I could talk to you for hours and hours, but at this time of the show, we have a little bit of fun. So we're going to have a rapid fire round. No need to put much thought into these questions. Just give me the first answer that comes to your head, okay?
Okay.
All right, here we go. The day is going awful. It is the worst day or week ever. Everything that it could have possibly gone wrong has gone wrong. Things that never go wrong have gone wrong. You get home. What do you want to drink?
Chances are, I've already had something.
Okay. And what's the nightcap, though?
Oh, it would be a glass of champagne or a dry white wine, higher acid, what I call a reset.
Yes. Listen, I'm here for a champagne reset. I'm going to start resetting my bad days with champagne.
There you go.
Okay. Polar opposite. Everything that could have possibly gone well has gone exceptionally well. You found a $100 bill on the floor. Like, your lottery scratch off ticket was $100. Everybody showed up on time for the reservations. Like, literally everything that could have gone well in the day has gone well. What do you want to drink?
Champagne.
I hear that. Yes, champagne for every occasion.
Our bubbles.
I love it.
You know,
I agree.
And it's a mood elevator. If you are not feeling fantastic, have a glass of bubbles. Have a glass
of
champagne.
It'll fix it.
And
they can't see me, but that's what I'm pouring.
Yes, you are. I see you. You know? And it's,
oh,
it's
I agree.
True. You know? It's true. It really is. And if you don't have that, higher acid white, something with some texture.
Mm-hmm. You know, I love a good body, yaddy, yaddy.
Yep.
I'm here for white burgundy every day of the week.
Yep.
Okay, this one is fun and it's always controversial. A grape or region, really a grape, that can leave the face of the earth, never to be grown, never to be vinified, never to be bottled again. What's the grape that can go?
Oh, gosh.
This is always a stumper, but I love the answers.
I think everything has a time and a place and a situation.
Okay.
That it all works with, right?
Okay.
But for me, it's more about a style. super, super reductive, flabby, just not a personality of its own.
Okay.
That could all go away.
All right. Bleh. Imposter wines then. Bleh. We're going to, I don't know how to spell that, but bleh wines.
Bleh.
Got it. Got it. Got it. Got it. Well, before we wrap up, I need everybody to know where they can follow you on social. If you have a website, direct them to it. Let the people know, because they're going to listen to this and they are going, if they haven't, I think most of my listeners should know who you are. But if they don't, where can they follow you online?
On Instagram, I am Noir Sommelier.
Yes.
When it pops up, it says Dame Tonya Pitts, because I am a dame. I'm a part of the Dame Biscoffier, a food and beverage organization that is international. We do a lot of outreach and mentorship within the community, and it's all things food and wine, whether you are a chef, a winemaker, a sommelier, a writer, all of it, all encompassing. So
put some respect on her name. It is Dame Tonya Pitts. I love that for you, by the way. It's so appropriate.
And TonyaPitts.com. That's my website.
Boom. Okay. So if you want to have the Tonya Pitts experience, you go to her website, you can book virtual, send in your things. You know, I joke around a lot, but I have to end this. I would be remiss without saying I'm truly honored by this. You know, we've talked a lot through Instagram and other spaces. You know, we've connected on our connections with our family, and you guys follow me. You know, my dad and my family and my nieces and all that are a huge part of who I am. But I'm so glad to have had you here to have a robust conversation about all of you. You as a Black woman, you as a beverage director, you as an educator, you as a mentor, you as all of these things, because all of those things bring such tremendous and robust value that people like me, you are a gold standard and a role model. Like, I almost wish I never said an expletive during this podcast, but you know, God ain't done with me yet. I'm not beyond expletives. But you inspire me every day to be better and to push myself to learn and to grow and to be more creative and to stretch, to be a better person and to continue to contribute to this industry as authentically as I can while staying true to myself. And there will never be enough words to thank you for being such a pillar and an inspiration to all of us. So thank you.
Thank you so much. And everybody, if you are ever in California, in the Bay Area, in Northern California, please come and see me.
Yes.
At One Market Restaurant, and come and have the Tonya Pitts experience at One Market.
Listen, get your VIP tickets. Som TV when I come to SFO. Before I drive up to wherever I'm going, I'm definitely coming in. I cannot wait to see you in person and give you a big old hug. Guys, that is our episode for this week. I want to thank you all for always listening and for sharing these incredible conversations with the amazing people that shape and guide the culture of food and wine and bring their own special flair and magic to it. So until next week, guys, cheers. Oh my goodness, guys, thank you so much for listening to this week's episode. We are offering a special gift to all of my amazing listeners. If you haven't subscribed yet, head on over to SomTV.com. Right now, if you enter the code Shakera, S-H-A-K-E-R-A, you will get 50% off your annual membership. And so that makes sure you don't miss any of the amazing content, including a couple of things that feature me, on SomTV. Head on over to SomTV.com, use code Shakera, and sign up for your yearly subscription now.